Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I'm so glad you could join me to talk a little bit of some cardboard classics, or classic cardboard, if you want to look at the other way around. And that's actually something we're going to be doing with this week's show. We're going to be looking at cards the other way around. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Matt, what are you thinking? What are you talking about here? Well, I'm talking about the designs of cards, but not in the way that you're thinking of it. If I ask you to close your eyes, and don't do this if you're driving, but if I ask you to think of 87 Tops, instantly, within just a couple of seconds, your mind's eye goes, ah, yeah, 87 Tops, looks like this. Likewise, if I say 81 Fleer or 86 Donruss or, you know, 92 Upper Deck, 73 Tops, you know, you know what I'm getting at. We're so familiar with the design of cards that once somebody throws out a suggestion, you can pretty much instantly create that image in your mind's eye. You know what these cards look like. And even if you were to remove the photographs, if you were to remove the team names, if you were to remove the player names and team logos and all that, and you were just left with the template of the baseball card design, you can still look at it and go, that's a whatever, you know, year and make and model. You know that. You've been surrounded by cards for a long time in your life, so you can do that. But can you do that with the back of a card? So, for example, if I said 81 Fleer, can you think of what the back of the 81 Fleer cards look like? Or 73 Tops or 86 Donruss, like I said. 87 Tops, you probably can, because that's one that you're constantly seeing. But maybe some of the more obscure ones. Do you remember what the 92 Upper Deck backs look like? Do you remember what a 61 Tops back looked like? Maybe not the design, but as simple as the colors. It takes a little more. You may know it, but you got to think a little bit more about it. And even though you've been exposed to cards for all these years, you still have to sit and think and go, oh, yeah, that's right. You know, the 86 Donruss used this color and 61 Tops had this design and didn't have the career stats, just had the stats from the previous year listed on it. And you can start remembering slowly but surely bits and pieces come your way. Oh, yeah, they had, you know, this and that listed on there. So the backs of cards, that's something that we often overlook when you're talking about baseball cards. And we're not going to overlook it on this week's podcast, as we will be talking to Andy of Sport Card Backs. And I have to really emphasize it's sport without an S at the end, Sport Card Backs. He is also the co-host, along with Mark Mosley, of Baseball Beyond Batting Average. That's BBBA underscore podcast, if you're looking for it on Twitter. I was a guest on their program a few weeks ago talking about the Mount Rushmore of American League East teams. And they do a great job with some lighter fare, such as the Mount Rushmore topic. But also, if you're a stats guy, that's the type of show that you want, Baseball Beyond Batting Average. They dive into not only the statistics, but also the stories of players, and it's a very fun podcast to listen to. And Andy has had a penchant for the backs of baseball cards. And it's an interesting story how he got into paying more attention to the backs rather than the fronts of baseball cards. And it's actually something that has paid off well for him in his professional life, in his career now. So something that started 30, 35 years ago with baseball cards is actually paying dividends now as an adult who has to pay the bills. And he, like many collectors, including yours truly, is somebody who got into cards, got away from cards for a little bit just because of life, and then got back in several years ago. In fact, he credits this podcast for getting him back in. So I'm glad that I could be of some assistance there. So I had a chance to talk to Andy a few days ago, and we'll share that conversation with you in just a few minutes. Also this week, In an effort to, again, mix it up just a little bit, because we're talking about the backs of baseball cards, but also just to do a little house cleaning, I just grabbed a few random packs that I've had in storage for a while. These were packs that I had purchased in past lots. We had put some up to polls, you know, which pack should we open up this week? So I had a few extra. I had an 85 Donruss Rack pack, an 86 Fleer Cello pack, and an 82 Topps Cello pack. And I did that random assortment basically because of the different backs of cards. And we'll talk a little bit about the backs in just a moment. So there's really no rhyme or reason for the particular years or makes or models of the cards that I chose this week. But some very interesting names, some really interesting stories, as usual, I picked out for the cards. And we'll tell you a little bit about the players that I selected later on in the program. But also our video link, which went out yesterday. I had to trim it a little bit. Apparently, YouTube's a little stuffy once your video goes past 15 minutes. So I had to trim about 30 seconds off of it. But the video link, which went out yesterday, we have a little bit of a discussion about the backs of the cards, and you can see the differences between an 85 Donruss, an 86 Fleer, and an 82 Topps. Not the best difference, I'll be honest. I probably should have just gone through some of my older cards and just picked out a few from a box and did some contrasting and comparing. But we'll talk about that a little bit later on. So look for the YouTube link. It is Wax Ecstatic Baseball Cards Got Back. A little Sir Mix-a-Lot joke there. It's not very funny, but it's a Sir Mix-a-Lot joke nonetheless. And just look at that, and you can watch through some of the cards that we pulled there, and you can see the differences. Although chances are, through your own collections, you've collected various cards from those early to mid-80s sets, and you've seen the differences yourself. And another thing that doesn't make it the best comparison, unfortunately, is, you know, I didn't have an 87 or an 88 Fleer. I have some 89 Fleer just sitting in a box somewhere, but I just really had no desire to open up 89 Fleer for some reason. But as we'll discuss, you know, Fleer in the late 80s and into 1990 got into some pretty interesting statistical breakdowns of players and their performances. So we discussed that with Andy in just a little bit, and I'll kind of opine on that just a little more. Now, as we like to do, we like to remind you that Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday. So our next podcast will be on Friday, August the 16th, and it will come out at noon Eastern via our home base at Audio Boom, but also wherever else an RSS feed gets grabbed. So you can listen in on iTunes, also iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Blueberry, Spotify, and Google Play. And like I said, there are many, many other ways that the podcast gets from point A to point B. If you're on a Southwest Airlines flight, you can listen to it via iHeartRadio. How cool is that? So, you know, you've read the emergency card over and over again, and you want something a little more appealing than being reminded how to buckle your seatbelt, you can do that. It's a very cool thing that iHeartRadio has set up with Southwest, and they've had it set up there for a while. And there are other airlines, too, that you have the internet access, and you can just go to, you know, whatever the source is of your favorite podcast. You can listen to them on that long flight to wherever you're going before the summer wraps up. So we'll be coming back here again 2 weeks from today. Again, Friday, August the 16th will be our next podcast, and we'll see what interesting stuff we come up with then. I did make a stop at the local card show / flea market and picked up a few interesting things. I picked up a ton of 86 Topps rack packs as I go through several packs to try to complete the set, try to narrow down the needed cards. And also a box of 88 Topps Cello. And 88 Topps is one of those sets where, you know, this is what this show has done to me, as well as a lot of our listeners. You take a second look or maybe a third look at a set that you didn't really care much for once upon a time, and you go, you know, it's actually not that bad. And 88 Topps is quite possibly that set. I was never a big fan of it, although, you know, I bought lots of it when I was a youngster, when I was just getting into the card collecting world, and you know, 1989, 1990. And I've told this story before where basically I bought a lot of 88 Tops because it was cheap. I could afford it. It could never quite live up to the billing of its predecessor, the legendary 87 Tops set. So 88 Tops was always available and cheap. And I didn't get much bang for my buck. So I kind of, in my mind, just went, yeah, 88 Tops, screw it. And, you know, just kind of buried it in the back. But, upon further reflection, doing one podcast about 88 Tops and then going through a vending box of 88 Tops, I want to say about a year ago, and it was a great box. A lot of assortment, but also... or a good assortment of cards, but also, the color really popped on them. And speaking of card backs, I liked the orange card back, which was very reminiscent of what Topps did in 1964, the white black text, I should say, on orange. In 64, it was a white text on orange. And harkened back to one of my favorite sets, 78 Tops, again, an orange back, this time with the blue printing. So I came around to 88 Tops. So, you know, one of the dealers that I normally hit up for the bargain bin beauties, he's selling a 88 Tops cello box for, what was it, like $9. And, I had mentioned, I said, oh, okay, I'm going to circle around, look at the other tables, but I'm coming back. I'm going to get one of these. He's like, you can have it for $5. So again, like every other bargain bin beauty that we find, it's the, well, why not? I mean, it's 24 cello packs for a whopping $5. And even though 88 Tops didn't live up to the bar that was set so high by 87 Tops, still, I mean, you've got Greg Maddux, you've got the Tom Glavin rookie, you've got early career cards for, Fred McGriff. Let's see, Roberto Alomar in that one? I think he is. You've got, so many of the stars from the 1980s and even the late 70s. You've got your Ripkins and your Gwynns and your Boggs and your Clemens and your Goodens. So many good players in there and some pretty good cards, but, often overlooked. And I prefer to get those bargain bin beauties when I can. So perhaps that's what we discuss on the next show, but you'll have to find out. You'll have to join us on August the 16th to see exactly what that is going to be. Now, you can make a donation to Wax Ecstatic. It helps us out in one of two ways. One, all donations go back right into the program to pay Audio Boom to host not only the new shows, but also the archives, which you can listen through those RSS feeds. But also, it helps buy products. So whether we're picking up the bargain bin beauties, these 88 or 86 Tops just for the hell of it, or if we're diving into some specific cards, some rather unique niche sets or players, then we can do that as well. And in fact, that I was able to pick up a few bargain bin cards too that we may put a focus on. A unique look at cards that are a little banged up, to put it nicely, but when you can pick them up for 10 or 12 bucks, I'm talking, I picked up a Reggie Jackson second year card, a Harmon Killebrew third year card recently for just a few bucks. Again, it's the, well, why not? Sure, the condition's a little beat up, but if you don't care, then, why not go for it? In fact, we actually had a listener on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed recently comment about the wonderful thing about picking up some slightly used cards, may we say. Robert Lawson chiming in on this is that when they are beat up, you get to actually touch them. And, that's a nice change of pace, isn't it? Normally, we're so used to these cards being locked into the PSA grading cases. It's actually nice to, take, if you wanted to, a slightly beat up Reggie Jackson second year card and actually hold it, because it's already got creases and rounded corners, so why not? So your money goes to good use here. Again, the products such as unopened wax or rack packs or these star cards or unique sets, the stuff that we talk about on the show, it all goes right back here, 100% of it. And again, any excess material, so for example, if I'm opening up that 88 cello tops box and I've got 300 or 400 dupes that I don't want to just sit in my closet, we put them together in care packages that go out to one of two organizations. The one that will be receiving the next package, and then once I get my hands on some spare boxes, I'd imagine they'll be getting this in a few weeks. Commons for Kids. They will take common cards, current and older cards, and they will put them together in care packages for kids, donations basically. And it helps kids who are less fortunate have something to do with their spare time, but also gives them something else to think about than whatever's troubling them in life, and gets them looped into the hobby. And then the other group that we send cards to, so they won't get the next package, they'll get the one after that, is Kidorty cards. And I had somebody ask about that. It is Kidorty, Kidority, and cards with a K. So if you type in Kidorty cards on Twitter, you'll find their account. And what they do is they take the donations as well. And it's not just baseball. They do football. They do racing, basically any sport. They will take these common cards and they will sort them by teams. And people will sign their kids up for a monthly package. So let's say your son or daughter's a fan of the Cincinnati Reds. Well, you sign up for Kidorty cards, small monthly fee. They will send you a pack. I believe it's 30 cards of just Cincinnati Reds cards. So it's a great way for your child to not only get involved or stay involved in the hobby, but also, depending on the age of some of these cards, learn a little bit about players who no longer play for their favorite team, or maybe some star players who once did. And it's a very unique business there. So again, Kidorty cards and commons for kids, the recipients of some of our excess product, we like to say. It's a rather business-like term, isn't it? The dupes. They will receive those. So know, again, that I'm not just stocking up on my card collection here. A lot of these extra cards will go out to kids. And the main thing is that they're going to kids who maybe can't afford baseball cards on a regular basis. So they get those cards. They get to hold their favorite players from their favorite teams in their hands. And it's a very good operation. Both of them are. So those cash donations, which you can make via PayPal at paypal.me/waxecstatic, go into great causes throughout the card collecting world, as well as just keeping Wax Ecstatic alive and well, from a technical aspect with Audio Boom to a product aspect. It helps me buy the things that we get to talk about on this program. So again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. Thank you if you have made donations. We've got some consistent donors too. Every few months we get a few bucks here and there from them, so we thank you for your consistency. And if you haven't donated yet, even if it's just $5 or $10, it goes a very long way. So please consider making those donations to help keep the program going, but also in the long run to help kids connect to the hobby in a very affordable and in some cases charitable way. Now, I did mention Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter timeline. It's always open 24/7. A lot of interesting conversation the last couple of weeks, and a lot of people, you know, doing not the Fan Friday thing, but doing shout outs as well. And we certainly appreciate that. So if you don't already collect, pass it along, or let me change that up. So if you collect, but you want to tell a friend who maybe gave up on collecting a while back, or is, looking to get back into the hobby, or is in the hobby knee deep, they just don't know about our program, tell them to follow Wax and Gum Stains. We've got a lot of very interesting commentary going on. So again, a lot of shout outs looping us in, which is great. A lot of conversation about how nice it is that the collecting podcasters get along well, and we do. We play rather nicely in the sandbox, and I don't see why not. I mean, everyone has something to offer. I'm talking, mostly junk wax, but a lot of older cards, and I've got a different way of talking about cards and a different way of purchasing them and collecting them than somebody else. So I'm always of the belief the more the merrier. Let's all talk about what we collect and how we collect it and why we collect it, and work with one another. And I will say this, I've been reached out to by another podcaster, another collector who's got some great ideas about, bringing some podcasters together for a bigger project, which is a great idea. Not my idea. He looped me into it. And I said, let's look into this. So perhaps over the next few months, you may see a collaborative effort to come up with some even greater content than what is out there now. And speaking of wax and gum stains, I actually received yesterday from our good buddy, Nick Deonte, who was on the show earlier, forwarded on a tweet from, let's see, who was it? GoGTS Live, who is at the national show, says, does anybody need any packs? And I am just so jealous looking at this picture here because I see some 73s. I see some 70 tops. How much is that going for? Let me see. $800. Oh, if I only had $800 to just throw around. I see some 76, some 78, some 83, 77, 75s. Got some cello packs here from 78 and 79. If you're at the National Card Show this weekend, feel free to share your pictures too, again, at Wax and Gum Stains. And the rest of us can be jealous that you're there. And we're not. One of these days I'll get up there for the show. And plus, it's in Chicago this year. Love going to Chicago, especially during the summer. Here in Florida, we bake in the summer. You sweat a gallon of sweat just going from your front door to your car in the driveway. Chicago in the summer is a great place to be, and it certainly balances out the absolutely brutal winters that you guys get. So if you're at the national show, share your pictures and thoughts and comments too. Certainly looking forward to that. Now, we're looking forward to some very unique stories from some of the cards that I pulled from this rather random assortment. Again, 85 Donruss Rack, 86 Fleer Cello, and 82 Top Cello. But before we get to that and some more of my pontification about the card backs, let's bring in the expert about card backs. We're bringing in Andy. He would like to remain just Andy because he is a math teacher by day and a voracious card collector at night. And not just any old card collector, he specializes in the backs of baseball cards. And how he got to, you know, specialize in the backs of cards rather than the front of cards is rather interesting. So we'll get to learn a little more about Andy, about some of his favorite card backs, and in particular, some of the trivial tidbits of card backs. And we'll get to learn a little more about the history of card backs, and I'll expound a little more on it later. But it's kind of a homework project for you. As you're going through your cards, flip them over. And I need to do this more. I need to spend more time looking at cards from the back rather than the front, because there's a lot of treasures out there. There's a lot of gems, whether it's a weird trivial tidbit or a funny cartoon or kind of a double entendre. Andy and I will talk about a couple of those. You got to look at the backs more than fronts. So I'll charge that to you while you listen to our conversation. Again, Andy from Sport Card Backs and a co-host of the Baseball Beyond Batting Average, BBBA podcast, joining us now on Wax Ecstatic. Our guest this week is somebody who I've had plenty of conversations with, first through various DMs on Twitter and also some conversation in front of everybody on Twitter. And also I was joined by his partner in crime, Mark, on their podcast talking about the Mount Rushmore of American League East teams, which was a pretty stirring debate as we talked more about the players that couldn't get onto Mount Rushmore as opposed to the four that we commonly selected. But we are very pleased to be joined by Andy of Sport Card Backs, and that is the Twitter handle Sport, no S at the end, Card Backs. And we're going to talk a little bit about the backside, the B-side, if you will, of baseball cards. Andy, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Thanks for having me. This is a thrill to be on here after listening to so many episodes and really having your show rekindle an interest in the hobby for me. Get me back into it. It really was part of the motivation for me starting the Twitter account in the first place.
And before we talk a little bit about how you first started in the hobby and how you got back, tell everybody about your podcast that you and Mark do. It's a really entertaining program, and how can they follow it on Twitter, and how often does the podcast come out?
So it's called Baseball Beyond Batting Average, and like Matt said, it is a collaboration between Mark Mosley and I, and Mark is on Twitter as @Mosley_Mark. You might know him as I Draw Baseball Cards, because that's what he does. He draws pictures of actual baseball cards usually, and, you know, caricatures them up a little bit. And the podcast started out as an investigation into advanced baseball stats, into these new saber metrics that are all the rage over the last several years, have really come into the common language of baseball. And we wanted to learn about them ourselves and also introduce listeners to them one stat at a time. We are also huge baseball fans and baseball card fans, though, so there's a lot of that in there. So if you're worried about it being too stat-heavy, I think it appeals to anyone who's a baseball fan, because we really get into the players, the stories. We have a good time. We joke around a lot. And we have pretty good following of people, but we would love to have some more. That on Twitter, it is @BBBA_podcast. All right. And as Matt said, we've gotten into other topics besides stats, like the Mount Rushmores of different divisions in baseball, just as an example of some other things that we do, using stats along the way, of course.
Of course. And take it from me, somebody who is not, I mean, I'm all about numbers as well. I don't dive as deeply as some people do. This is certainly not a stuffy program that Andy and Mark have here. It's very entertaining. So check it out again. Baseball Beyond Batting Average, or BBBA_podcast, for local listings and airtimes, et cetera, et cetera. So the hobby... Yeah, you were probably like everybody else. I mean, you probably started collecting at a young age. How did you get into the hobby? And then how and why did you get back? How did this all happen? Because it seems to be a common thing, Andy, especially with our generation, where people start it, they kind of go away for a while, but something just sucks them right back into the whole thing.
Yeah, it's funny. You and I are the same age, and it's interesting to listen to you describe your journey through collecting and how similar it was to mine, because just like you, I got started at a young age. I was probably younger than most. I was about 6. And I know I was younger than you because you've talked about starting in like 89, but I actually started collecting with 84 tops. And I had the fortune of having an older brother who started collecting that year, I think through some prodding from my dad. And so I have a bunch of 84 tops, and then really in 86 was when I started on my own really getting into it. And that was my passion. I mean, that was my life for about 5 or 6 years. And just like you, when I grew up and got into other things, including females, baseball cards kind of fell by the wayside.
Imagine that. It's not a chick magnet for most people.
A distant second. But, you know, as I got older, and like I said, your podcast had a lot to do with it, I kind of started listening as a nostalgia thing, like, oh man, this would be great to listen to a show about something that was such a big part of my life for so many years. And then I just slowly started getting back into it, like, hey, this would be fun to just, you know, pick up a few here and there. And I've gone to card shows, and those are a blast just to look through. And, you know, I'm not a big spender. I'll spend maybe $10 at a card show. And, you know, I'm still not a huge collector. Mark likes to say that I have the world's worst baseball card collection. And that's because I kept everything from when I was a kid, and that was the junk wagon era. So I have tons of worthless cards, but I value them all the same.
Yeah, you know, even the quote-unquote worthless ones, it's still kind of neat, and especially, you know, for me, it's still opening up the packs. And you may get that one Griffey card that is now valued at a whopping 75 cents. It would have been worth $10 back in the day. But, you know, still just flipping through the cards, and you see some of the names, and you remember some of the, you know, teams and teammates of the players, and it brings back a lot of good memories. Now, I do need to ask you this, Andy. Card backs. Why is your focus on card backs? And is that something that you focused on as a kid as well, or is this something that was more recent?
No, I've always been into them. I am a middle school math teacher, And I've always been a math guy. I've always been into stats. And, you know, I don't know what came first. It's kind of a chicken and egg situation, whether I was kind of predestined to like numbers and stats, or if I got into stats because of the backs of baseball cards. But that was definitely where it started for me, was flipping over the card and seeing what was on the back. And as a 6 or 8 year old, looking at the backs of these cards, at first it was kind of confusing. You know, I didn't really understand what all the numbers were. Obviously, you can imagine a 6 year old trying to figure it out. But I remember seeing like 2B and 3B. And even that to me was confusing. I was like, what is that? What does that even mean? And, you know, later I figured what that, and like slugging, SLG, you know, I didn't know what that was for years. But I was just fascinated with the stats. In 1986, Topps came out with a set that had italics on the back.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was the coolest thing, that you could see who the league leaders were. And it also included game-winning RBIs. There's a deuce stat at the bottom. And I was just, you know, I was totally immersed in these stats. And, like, I remember looking at the Pete Rose card, and you could barely read it. It was so, there was so much on there. The font was so tiny. But, yeah, I've always flipped them over. There were pictures of me as a kid looking at cards, and I'm looking at the backs of them. Like, I'm flipping the cards over and looking at the back as soon as I open them.
That's just what you did. It just came natural to you one way or the other. So it's been a lifelong thing for you.
Yeah. I've always been into the backs. Like I said, I started out with the stats. I didn't really appreciate the, I think, mostly unintentional comedy that is on the backs of these cards as a kid. I wasn't really into reading the facts and stuff. But as I got into them later and started this Twitter account, that's when I really dug into them. I was like, oh my gosh, there's a treasure trove of ridiculousness on the backs of these cards that needs to be exploited, needs to be put out there for other people to enjoy.
This is something, and a little showcasing into my history in baseball too. And I think I shared this either on the last podcast or the podcast before that. I talked about my time working with the then Tampa Bay Devil Rays, playing music and clicking a computer mouse to update the scoreboard as the play was going on. And there was one summer where the guy who was in charge of the whole operation actually paid me. I couldn't believe somebody paid me to do this, but actually paid me to look up obscure stats and storylines of never mind the Devil Rays players. It was more about the visiting team. Because, you know, this is before they had the shiny new Daktronic scoreboard. It was more of an older scoreboard that had less stats and more space for narrative. And I remember challenging myself, all right, the Chicago White Sox, for example, they're coming to town. Let me go through the active roster and find 3 bullet points of information that somebody may find remotely entertaining. And I can tell you, especially with some of the lesser-known players, finding even 3 factoids about them. Sometimes after factoid number 1, you're really scratching and pulling, and you're coming up with factoids like, you know, Raul Casanova was born 2 days, or made his major league debut 2 days before Tropicana Field opened. You know, you're just coming up with these bizarro stats. So I love some of the stories that you share, because I know that there was some researcher at Topps 30, 40 years ago who has to go through roughly 800 ball players, and the Pete Roses and the Nolan Ryans and the Mike Schmidts. I mean, those are the easy ones, if you had room for facts, because like you said, their stats normally took up the entire back of the card. But trying to find something remotely entertaining for, say, Biff Pocaroba or Buddy Biancolana, besides just some random stat like, oh, he had a 2-hit game on such and such date, that's hard to do. So, you know, knowing the background of that, I can only chuckle at some of these stories that you post, because I know there's just some poor schlub working in the Topps office, banging his head against the desk going, what can I find out about Carmelo Martinez? Got to get one more fact. So with that said, Andy, what are some of your favorites off the top of your head that you can think of that have mystified you over the years?
Well, I've, I've got a few here. I just want to add a little bit onto what you said there. The players who have been around a shorter amount of time are the ones they had to fill up the most space.
Yep.
So, you know, Pete Rose, you didn't have to put factoids because his stats put it up. But the unknown rookie who had maybe 5 years in the minors, you had to fill up the back with something. So that makes it even more entertaining and more, you know, difficult, I guess, for the fact finder. So I've got a bunch. It's hard for me to narrow it down to just a few, but, you know, one of my favorites, 87 Tops, is one of the sets that collectors in general seem to love from the 80s because of the design on the front. The backs of 87 Tops are great also. Tops seem to a theme for each set for the backs. And 87 Tops, they decided we're going to put some personal information about these players, but the way that they wrote them was so awkward. There were a lot of players that derived enjoyment from things. Tim Burke, remember the reliever for the Expos, mm-hmm. among other teams? The back of his card in his 87 Top says he experiences much enjoyment from reading.
Ah.
What a weird way to say it, you know?
That sounds like somebody, you know, an intern trying to justify their, you know, fall internship at Tops. You know, not only does Tim Burke read, he, you know, gets enjoyment from it. So what type of enjoyment?
He experiences much enjoyment.
Yeah, what kind of enjoyment he experiences, we shall not say, because we're not really sure what the reading material is. But we're just damn glad he's enjoying a good book, aren't we?
You can read between the lines.
Exactly.
There's a Ron Guitry in that set that says, Ron is quite proficient at the drum. And I put that one out and said, this is when Ron Guitry's mom was employed as a top card back writer, temporarily.
So,
that's how it sounds like.
If Ron Guidry was proficient, yeah. If Ron Guidry was proficient with a drum, what does that make, you know, Keith Moon or somebody who is just incredibly awesome, but more than proficient? I don't know. I guess he just hit the beat right. Yeah, proficient.
Yeah, that's a term we use in schools. I don't know how it applies to the drum.
Yeah.
There's an 85 top. The 85 kind of had the same thing. 85 top. Listed, they didn't have quite the same language, but they listed personal facts. And there's one with Lynn Barker, 85 Top, that says, list his favorite food as wild game.
You know, one look at Lynn Barker doesn't surprise me at that.
Yeah. 81 Top's Bucky Dent says, once starred in a movie, and this is, of course, accompanied by a little cartoon, once starred in a movie with the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders.
Oh, well.
I think the movie is called The Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders Movie. I looked it up. I think that's the name of it.
Oh. Yeah, because of all the things Bucky Dent is best known for.
His role in that movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes when I go to these card shows, I look at the back. I like looking at the front, too, and sometimes I buy them because of what's on the front, but I'll flip them over, too, and if I find a nugget in the back that I like, I'll purchase it. I posted one recently. It was the 1975 Topps Bob Hansen. And that year they put trivia questions at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And the question says, what did Don Zimmer put in his mouth before each game?
Answer everything.
It was chewing tobacco.
Oh, yeah, that too.
There's a lot of reasons for that question. Would not make it today, would not pass the editors.
Yeah. There's another one. I remember there used to be a line of books called the Baseball Hall of Shame. And this would have been late 80s, early 90s. I forget who cobbled these stories together. But I remember each book had a chapter on baseball cards. And there was one, I want to say it's Sparky Lyle 72 Tops, I want to say,
mm-hmm.
where... it's a trivia question, and the question is, how long is the pitcher's rubber? Which, of course, leaves much to the imagination to those who may not be familiar with the long white slab on top of the pitcher's mound.
Right.
But Sparky Lyle was very popular with the ladies, I believe. But, you know, again, you can read between the lines there. And I love, you know, I've gone through, you know, I'll get a box of just 73 or 68 or whatever. And when I say a box, you know, there's like 30 or 40 of these cards. And, you know, I don't care about the condition. I got them real cheap. I'm just flipping through them. And I've been mesmerized just looking at the backs more than the front sometime, because if it isn't the factoid itself, especially some of the cartoons that were drawn in the 60s and 70s, I mean, you talk about some wit in a caricature. I mean, the Topps artists went over the top with some of them.
Yeah, especially 74 and 75. There's some pretty comical cartoons from those sets. You mentioned the pitching rubber, which made me, well, I didn't say pitching, but the thing that made me think of was I posted an 85 Topps Frank DePina. It's been a year or two since I did this, but I said this was the closest the card ever came to talking about sex. It says, Frank and his wife, Diane, were married early in 1983. Their daughter was born late in 1983. And I just imagined a yada, yada, yada in between those two sentences.
Well, Frankie goes to Hollywood, and all the ladies love it.
Yeah.
Andy from Sport Car Backs joining us here on Wax Ecstatic this week. It's, again, some of the stories are great. Some of the tidbits are. The designs, too, I've always, and on this podcast, especially when I've gone back to cards from the 40s and 50s, I'm amazed at the evolution of cards. And I've noticed, as I've gone back, it happens with the card backs, too. It's, you know, the card companies over the years have had to, you know, adjust to consumer demands. And, you know, what's popular with the consumer one year isn't necessarily going to be as popular 3 or 4 years down the line. And I always thought it was fascinating looking at the backs of cards. If you look at cards from the late 40s and early 50s, it's a lot of text. It's a lot of reading. Not necessarily stats. It's all words. It's narrative. But then in 1954, you saw it with Topps. And Bowman, of course, was about to run out of gas. But you saw it with Topps. And they totally changed the back of the card from a written story into basically comic book panels. And I find it interesting that this was done during the golden age of television. You know, everybody suddenly had pictures, moving pictures in their homes. So it's like Topps had to add some art, some pictures to the back of the cards to tell the story. And then as time goes on, you know, as the 60s come around, it's more stats, but with cartoons. The 70s, same thing. Like I said, there's more trivia than, you know, individual player stories. But then by the 80s, everyone just seemed to just Joe Friday, just the facts, man. It was all pretty much just numbers there. Have you noticed anything like that as well? Or is there some trend that happened in baseball card backs that stands out to you over the dawn of time?
I was interested to find out when the stats first showed up. As far as I could tell, the 1952 top was the introduction of stats on the back. There may be some set before that. You know, I'm not a baseball historian or a baseball card historian, but as far as I can tell, that's when it started. And I'm not sure what the thinking was, but I'm glad they did it. But early on in tops, there was kind of an oscillation between the total complete stats of the player all season shown versus the just the prior year. And they kind of went back and forth for several years doing that. And then, like you said, the comics came in the 60s and the 70s. 1971 top was the only set that had an actual photograph on the back for a while, for tops at least. And it was just that one year. And I guess they didn't like it. And didn't come back on top at least until 1993, at least the player, picture of the player. In the 80s, the competition came around for tops, and I think that inspired a new layout on the back. They added some new stats in 1981, slugging average, stolen base, saves, walks, strikeouts to the players. And kind of Fleer and Donruss followed suit. They pretty much stuck with that same format. Stats pretty much stayed the same for a while.
On this program, I opened up a rack pack of 85 Donruss, a Cello of 86 Fleer, even though it's not the best representative of a Fleer card I wanted, and some 82 Tops just to show some differences. And it's funny how Donruss pretty much just stayed the same from, like, you know, with a few variations in the early 80s. Basically, they just ran the exact same formula on the back of their card up through 1991. And then, you know, Tops kind of, you know, not only brought in more advanced stats, but also simplified it. And I'm not saying that in a good way. You know, the cartoons started disappearing in the mid 80s. And, you know, maybe they were replaced with a logo or a trivia question or something. But, you know, kind of the fun was sucked out of the cards. And then, of course, Fleer, you know, you mentioned 71 Tops. Fleer had the little black and white photo on the back in 83, 84, 85. But what I loved about Fleer was starting in 87, they started working with some advanced stats. So one year you had heat zones. Another year you had before the All-Star break, after the All-Star break. And this is something they did up through 1990, I believe. And even though the car companies were trying to differentiate themselves, of course, Score comes along with a professional scouting breakdown of every player. Yeah. Upper Deck's got the full color photograph on the back, as well as the hologram sticker. And then my favorite, your not-so-favorite, Bowman comes around again. And you've got the team-by-team splits, at least for the major leagues. The minor league guys had just said, you know, played in, you know, Class AA, Schenectady or whatever. So, I mean, the evolution, you know, went from very basic and bland in the early 80s to all of a sudden these wild stats and different presentations coming out in the late 80s. It's hard to for us old guys to tell younger people, this is before the internet. This is how we got this information. Right. I think you look back at it and you realize what an effort by all, okay, well, not Donruss, but pretty much all of these companies to even make the stats presentation and the storytelling a little different and try to outdo one another.
Yeah, there was a lot of, like, I think the point you made about Fleer is a good one. There's a lot of effort on their part, especially to mix it up. Tops' efforts were odd. I mentioned earlier they kind of had a theme for each year. And for example, in 1988, almost everybody had minor league highlights. So you had like 20-year veterans that would have a highlight of like Bob Boone led the PCL and chances accepted in 1969.
That's good to know.
It's like, do you really think that's gonna move the needle? You know, that's what's gonna get people to prefer your product to the other ones. I can't understand the decision making behind those things. But yeah, I do like what Fleer was doing. Donruss, like you said, is boring. I hated the 5 years of stats.
Yes.
And the format was just so static. It didn't change from year to year. So never really liked looking at those much and still don't post them very much. And then lately in the 2000s, you know, they've been coming up with even more and more innovations. I haven't been as much of a collector, but they did start with some more advanced stats. The WAR is on there now, 2014 on the Topps cards. And then in 2017, they added the Instagram and Twitter.
Yeah.
Not my favorite.
They're
trying to get into get with the times.
Yeah, and who knows, you know, maybe that speaks to, you know, mostly kids or younger collectors today. But I'm just wondering if in like 20 years, you know, my son and I are cracking open a box of 2019 Tops, you know, if they aren't overpriced again in 20 years. And he's like, Dad, what is this? What is, you know, hashtag baseball booty butt 45? It's like, oh, well, that was his, you know, Twitter handle. Yeah. So I'm curious how history is going to look back on those.
Yeah. It'll seem dated, just like everything from the 70s, like the chewing tobacco, you know, trivia question that I asked or that I read a little while ago.
Yeah.
The Twitter handles will probably seem just as dated in 20 years. Yeah. But, you know, I guess that's their attempt to stay relevant.
Yeah. And, you know, you have to do that even though there's only one company with the official product, you still got to sell it, and it's got to be more than just to the veteran collectors. Andy from Sports Card Backs joining us here on Wax Ecstatic. And we talked about some of your favorite quotes and lines from the backs of these cards. Are there any designs in general that you like and some that you absolutely hate? You mentioned the Donruss ones you didn't care for, but what has stood out, the good and the bad, over the years?
Well, I've stated before in other formats that I'm a huge fan of the scorecard backs, and you talked about that a little bit. But when that came out, that was everything you wanted. I mean, it was such a break from what we had been getting from the other card companies, the full color and the picture and the stats and the bio. Like, they made it all fit on there. And it was just like, why can't this be what everybody's doing? You know, so I've always liked those, and they pretty much stayed the same for a few years. Mm-hmm. And they were always good. And, you know, I really don't have a problem with the top card backs. I've liked those throughout the years, if for no other reason, because they have those interesting, hilarious nuggets that are not supposed to be funny necessarily, but are. You mentioned the Bowman cards that I didn't like. I did not like the breakdown of the stats on the Bowman cards. I didn't like the Donruss cards. And the newer cards have skimped on the stats. They haven't shown career stats for top, but apparently in 2019 they do have all the career stats there, and I do like the layout of the 2019 cards. I think the colors combined with the full stats, it all works. I think they put together a nice one this year in contrast to previous years.
Yeah, I think
those are some of my favorites.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the tops design in 2016, 17, 18, they were a little too similar. They were popular, but a little too safe. And I mentioned earlier this year when I bought a few 2019 packs, there's almost like a quiet ode to the 82 tops, the hockey sticks on the backs of the cards. And I don't know if that was intended, but if it wasn't, it's just good dumb luck. If it was, you know, that's a nice tip of the cap to, you know, people like us who have come back into the hobby, and you know, that's actually it's those little things that do hook the consumer every now and then. Well, Andy, what you've got coming up with the Sport Card Backs Twitter handle? Are there any interesting tidbits to be released upon the world soon? And also, what's coming up with baseball beyond batting average?
Well, with the Twitter account, it's pretty much just whatever catches my fancy. I did buy some cards this past weekend at a card show, like I said, and so there were some that I singled out as, yeah, I'm going to post that one. But it's pretty much whatever, you know, catches my eye that day. I'll look through some cards, mm-hmm. or I'll think of a certain player and then go search out that player. I also did start a thread where I'm posting the entire 1986 Topps Traded set in order. But I haven't done one in a while, so I need to get back on that. But people were pretty excited about that for whatever reason.
That's odd, but just go with it. All right.
Yeah, there's some pretty terrible players in that set, but that doesn't make it any less fun. I pretty much do one a day. And it's just, you know, like I said, whatever I think of that day, if I happen to look at one, I'll say, oh, yeah, I got to do that. And I'll do it, you know. For the podcast, we are now moving on to the National League divisions for our Mount Rushmores. We will be putting out a National League Central episode probably at the end of this week. And then we'll do the other two divisions. Like you referred to it, it is kind of our summer programming. We're kind of taking a break from what we normally do. And since we have some more time to interact with our Twitter followers and our listeners, we're including a lot more of their input and their opinions in these shows. So we'll wrap those up, and then we'll get back into doing more of our stat-based podcast after the summer is over, probably.
Andy, this was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed looking back at the backs of cards. It is something that we're going to talk a little more about throughout the remainder of the podcast. And I mentioned all the packs that we opened up in the video break. The four players I selected, I will not only share some interesting notes about them, but true to form, we're going to flip the cards over and find some interesting stat or interesting factoid, whatever the people at Topps, Fleer, and Donruss came up with in the early 80s, and we'll share that with everybody. So thanks again for being on our program. Thanks again for having me on yours a few weeks back, and enjoy the rest of your summer before the back-to-school grind gets at you, too.
Great. Thanks for having me. It's been a blast, and
Max Ecstatic is my new nickname. I think I'll create a business around that. All right, my thanks to Andy from Sports Card Backs for joining us, again, co-host of the Baseball Beyond Batting Average program, along with Mark Mosley. That's BBBA_podcast. And Mark will eventually be a guest on the program, too, because when Andy says Mark draws baseball cards, it's actually a pretty unique freehand experience, and it's kind of fun. And he will either recreate baseball cards or create his own. And after I was on the podcast a few weeks ago with them, he created one using my rather businesslike LinkedIn profile picture. But he really did a heck of a job pulling it together because, first of all, he makes my ugly mug look pretty good, which is always a difficult task. So the fact that you can make me look better while in cartoon caricature form is great. But also, he designed it with the 65 tops look to it. And you know the way to my heart there, 65 tops. Is one of my favorites, if not the favorite, Topps cards or baseball cards in general that I have. So thank you so much to Mark for doing that and for Andy for joining us. So like I said, Mark will eventually make his way on the show too and talk about his penchant for drawing baseball cards freehand and making ugly folks like myself look good. And as Andy and I discussed, nowadays it's a lot of social media. You've got Instagram and Twitter handles that are featured, and I'm just really curious how that is going to play out in, say, 30 years. Maybe it's a unique marker of history, kind of like if you go back to the cards of the 50s and go, hey, there's more photographs and cartoons here because it was a visual medium era. Maybe 40 or 50 years from now, people are looking back at a 2019 top set and are going, well, social media was a thing that, eventually destroyed society, but it was kind of cute at the time. So, a lot of interesting things that you can find on the backs of cards. And again, I highly recommend, especially if you have a set or a collection that goes back several years or decades, as the case may be, just grab a handful out of a box or flip through them in your binders and look at the backs and just go card to card back first. And especially Topps cards and some of the, the scorecards from the late 80s and early 90s, the Fleer cards from the 1980s, the Bowman cards, if you have some from their first 6 or 7 years coming back in the late 80s and early 90s, take a look at it. You'll have an appreciation for the backs of cards, but especially the Topps cards. If you have some that go back into the 70s and the 60s and the 50s, I think you'll find some pretty entertaining stuff, whether it be a funny cartoon or an interesting trivia tidbit that is featured on the backs of cards. Now, speaking of the backs of cards, the four cards that I selected from this random assortment of cards that I opened up, I'm going to give a little tribute to the backs of cards by finding one interesting note on the back of each of these cards. And of course, the stories of these players is always interesting. And we're going to start with a player that I mentioned, Jack Percante. Now, while I opened up the 85 Donruss rack, I saw the Jack Percante card, and he's featured in the Seattle Mariners blue and gold from 1984. That was his first season with the Mariners. Personally, for me, that's my favorite Mariners uniform. A lot of people go back to the original Trident uniform from the late 70s, but I've always liked the early 80s when they had the blue road uniforms. They would change to a gray road uniform in 1985. But I mentioned when I pulled the Percante card, I said, it sounds like a salsa, kind of like Pace Percante. Of course, that's not the case. It's Picante if you're looking for the salsa. But Jack Percante, let's start with the back of the card here. What's an interesting note? It says here in the career highlights, emerged as catalyst to Mariners attack in 84. Now, the Mariners attack, quote unquote, in 1984 often amounted to a minor skirmish. Think 6 days war if you're a history buff. The Mariners didn't have much of an attack in 1984, and they wouldn't for about another 10 years. But John Patrick Percante, that was another interesting thing about Donruss card backs. They featured the middle name of players. He actually was a key cog. In fact, you could argue the only one in 1984 for the Mariners, as he hit .294 that season, appeared in 155 games, and as the back of the Donruss card mentions, led the Mariners in hits, runs, and games played in 84. Now, he didn't actually lead a league in anything, as the asterisk would lead you to believe, but certainly one of the few players that you could get excited about for the Mariners in 1984. Now, as it would turn out, Percante would not be with the Mariners too long. In fact, he only played there in 1985 before getting moved on to the Chicago White Sox. But let's back up just a little bit, shall we? As he was drafted by the Los Angeles Dodgers, made his major league debut in 1980 with the Dodgers at the age of 26. A native of Joliet, Illinois, would play with the Dodgers for a couple of seasons, got moved on to the Cleveland Indians, where he played in 82 and 83, had a couple of seasons in Seattle, and then wrapped up his career with the Chicago White Sox in 1986. Now, he had an uncle, Frank Percante. If you are a fan of the series on HBO, Band of Brothers, you've heard that name before. Yes, Frank Percante was a member of the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division, best known as Easy Company. Yeah, that's the Air Force or the Airborne group that is featured in Band of Brothers, and there was an actor who portrayed Frank Percante in that series, and Frank Percante was the oldest living member of the Easy Company. He did pass away at the age of 96 back in 2013, but you know, he was somebody who didn't really get much notoriety until after Band of Brothers, and people realized who Frank Percante was. So, you know, Frank Percante, again, the uncle of Jack Percante, part of the Band of Brothers group, which is very, very interesting. Now, if you are a youth baseball coach, perhaps you have read Jack Percante's coaching manuals. Yes, after his major league career, Jack Percante authored three books: Creating a Season to Remember, the New Youth Sports Coaching Leadership Handbook, also The Making of a Hitter, a proven and practical step-by-step baseball guide, and Raising an Athlete, How to Instill Confidence, Build Skills, and Inspire a Love of Sport. He also has a website that gives advice on baseball, coaching, and parenting, and he's also been a feature writer for Baseball the Magazine for over 10 years. And also, according to a Wikipedia biography, Jack has run 11 marathons and continues to teach youth baseball and softball. So Jack Percante, again, not Pace Percante, not the salsa of family, certainly a valued career in baseball, very serviceable career over seven seasons, one of the few Mariners you could get excited about in 1984 and 85, but continuing to live his life as a coach and an author, and also related to the late, great Frank Percante of the Easy Company. Now, another 85 Donruss card here, and I kind of chuckled at this because it was a rated rookie card, and we always like to chuckle at rated rookie cards because more often than not, in the craze of the rookie cards in the 1980s, Donruss didn't really get it right when it came to rated rookies. Every now and then they would hit a home run with one, but often they didn't, and you can't really blame them for this one. Jim Traber, this was card number 45 in the 85 Donruss set. He was a first baseman slash designated hitter for the Baltimore Orioles, appeared in just 10 games in 1984, but had a career batting average of, or a season batting average, I should say, of .238 at that time. And it mentions on the back of this card here, made spectacular rise through the organization last year, moving from Class A Hagerstown all the way to the Orioles by season end. And we move on down a little bit here. Says Orioles hope he can win a spot as a designated hitter with them in 85, is regarded as the best hitting prospect in the organization. Well, as it would turn out, while Jim Traber was a very good hitting prospect for the Orioles, a veteran hitter by the name of Eddie Murray, perhaps you've heard of him, future Hall of Famer, didn't really budge off of first base. So much like the toughest position to play in the minor leagues was the shortstop for the Orioles Farm Club in Rochester, New York, because Cal Ripken wasn't going anywhere, being the guy behind Eddie Murray in the 1980s meant you were limited to some playing time while you were with the Orioles Farm Club. And that was the situation with Traber, who went up and down between the minor leagues and the major leagues often in the 1980s, played for the Orioles in 84, 86, and then got a little more playing time in 88 and 89. But for the most part, saw a lot more time in the minor leagues than he did in the major leagues. And in fact, let me see. Yeah, he got a ton of minor league time in 85 and 86, and then later on in 87 and 88. So while he had a lot of upside, wasn't really able to capitalize it, as not only Eddie Murray was parked at first base for Baltimore, but the Orioles really struggling to put together a winning team in the late 80s. So he kind of got shuffled off to the side and eventually played in Japan with the Kintetsu Buffaloes. In fact, he started a couple of legendary bench-clearing brawls in the Japanese League. Search YouTube, you might be able to find them. After his playing career, got into sports talk radio, also radio play-by-play. In fact, was a color analyst for the Arizona Diamondbacks on television in the early 2000s. In fact, was part of the team in the 2001 World Championship season. After his time with Arizona on the broadcast crew ended in 2003, became a talk show host in Oklahoma City. And here's another interesting fact about Jim Traber. And I'm going to dedicate this to you, Andy, because this one's a doozy. Folks, if you look for card number 484 in the 87 Topps set, and Andy mentioned that 87 Topps has some really interesting, really interesting points here. Jim Traber, you know, I almost want to leave it for you to find out, but just in case you don't have your 87 Topps card number 484 handy, all right, I'll read it out to you. The back of his card says, Jim is an accomplished professional singer. He sang the national anthem at Memorial Stadium on the night he made his major league debut, September 21st, 1984. So Jim Traber, not just frustrated backup first baseman slash DH with Eddie Murray in front of him, but accomplished singer, color analyst, and sports talk host. How about that for a major league debut? You not only make it to the bigs, but they tap you as the national anthem singer before you make your debut. That is a way to usher in things. Pete Vukovich. You know, we talked about Gorman Thomas in the last show. Pete Vukovich, the brother from another mother of Gorman Thomas, you could say. Some shaggy all-star players for the Milwaukee Brewers in 1983. And Pete Vukovich had quite the career, both on and off the field. Now, we're talking about his 82 Topps card number 643. And I think Andy mentioned this in our conversation. Topps started doing cartoons and trivia about other players as time went on in the 70s and 80s. And that was no different from 1982, as the back of Vukovich's card mentions Jim Palmer's career earned run average is the lowest in the American League since 1927. Now, not only is that interesting because what does Jim Palmer have to do with Pete Vukovich, dear Topps, but the two would actually cross paths in 1982. First of all, the Brewers and the Orioles had a pretty good rivalry going on in the early 80s, both teams battling for the American League East division back then, and they would crisscross each other numerous times, especially in 81 and 83. The Orioles would get the best of the Brewers in 1983, winning the American League East. But Pete Vukovich would actually edge out Jim Palmer for the Cy Young Award in 1982, Vukovich getting 14 of the 28 first-place votes, Jim Palmer the runner-up. So what seemed to be this rather random factoid on the back of Vukovich's 82 Topps card would turn out to be somewhat prophetic, even though Palmer had the lowest career earned run average for the American League in, at that time, 55 years. Vukovich would turn out to be the top pitcher in terms of performance for the 1982 season. Vukovich had quite the history, and a lot of these factoids were put together by, let's see, who had it? Rory Costello was the original author of this article. And of course, anytime you see anything through SABRE, the Society for American Baseball Research, it's updated and edited. But Rory Costello had the first full article about Pete Vukovich here. But Vukovich, like I said, could be the brother from another mother of Gorman Thomas, as they had a striking resemblance to one another. A mere 6'4", 220 pounds, as if his size wasn't daunting enough for hitters to hit against. Pete Vukovich was also slightly off his rocker. He did lots of weird things while he was on the mound. You know, not quite Al Hrabowski, not quite Turk Wendell, but, you know, and not, you know, Mark Fidrich, not quite that, but, you know, quirky. Like he would stick his tongue out while he's reading the catcher's signs from Ted Simmons, or he would have this kind of like nervous tick, you know, his head would rock a little bit. You know, just one of those quirky things from a quirky guy. He was born and raised in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and I've been to Johnstown. It's an interesting throwback town. Definitely up in the hills of western Pennsylvania. Comes from a family of Serbian descent. His father, not surprisingly, a steel worker in Johnstown. His mother, a homemaker. And as he grew up in Johnstown, he was the only boy among five children, and grew up with the Pirates in his backyard. Of course, a big fan of Roberto Clemente, but also took detailed notes of pitchers Bob Gibson and Juan Marichal. Now, he was a star in high school sports at Conemaugh Valley High School in Johnstown. There we go. Stood out in three sports, including football. He was a wide receiver. How would you like to run into that guy? Basketball as a forward, and of course, a star baseball player. In fact, the high school baseball field is named in his honor. Vukovich graduated from high school in 1970, turned down football scholarships from Navy, Pitt, Michigan State, among other schools, decided to focus on baseball and also focus on his soon-to-be wife, Anna Kuzak, who was going to Clarion State College in Northwest Pennsylvania. It's funny how girls tend to, you know, veer us off track a little bit, often lead us into good positions, but still. As a star baseball player at Clarion, he literally played every position but catcher. He was an all-conference player in the Pennsylvania State Athletics Conference from 1972 to 74, and was also an NAIA All-American in 1974. Recommended by the Chicago White Sox scout Fred Schaefer to get drafted, he was picked up by the White Sox in 1974, very quickly moved up through their organization, and even got to play a little winter ball in Puerto Rico. And started several times in 1976 for the White Sox. Sox weren't a very good team back then, but he would flip back and forth between a starter and bullpen. And, you know, it was kind of one of those weird things that Paul Richards would do as manager, you know, just try to utilize pitchers in different forms. In fact, Goose Gossage going from the bullpen to the starter position as a pitcher while with Chicago. So while he was very utility, I guess you could say, as a pitcher, the White Sox didn't know what to do with him, except they exposed him in the 1977 expansion draft. The Toronto Blue Jays come in and pick him up. And some very interesting notes from his time here. Pete Vukovich was credited with the first save in Blue Jays history, April 7th, 1977, and also pitched the first shutout in Blue Jays history, a 2-0 gem against the Baltimore Orioles. Now, the Blue Jays, of course, were a terrible team early on, so they decide to move Vukovich to St. Louis after the 1977 season. He and a player to be named later would turn out to be John Scott, went to St. Louis for Victor Cruz and Tom Underwood. And he would have a decent little career in St. Louis, kind of got straightened out by Claude Osteen. Again, going back and forth between the bullpen and the starting rotation, eventually settling down as a starting pitcher. And this is kind of where his personality starts coming out, too. He picks up the nickname Vuk the Spook. He had some sometimes strange behavior. And again, like I mentioned, sticking his tongue out and you know, having these little nervous tics while he's playing. Very competitive pitcher as well. And part of one of the biggest trades in baseball history, beneficial to both the Cardinals and their trading partner, the Milwaukee Brewers, the two teams who would meet up in the World Series in 1982. A trade that started as Larry Sorensen for Pete Vukovich eventually turns into the seven-player blockbuster as Vukovich, Raleigh Fingers, and Ted Simmons go to Milwaukee for Sorensen, Dave LaPointe prospect David Green, and Sixto Lescano, my favorite Harry Callis name to say. Sixto Lescano. So it turned out to be a win-win for both teams. Like I said, they both ended up playing one another in the 1982 World Series. And as I mentioned, Vukovich eventually winning the American League Cy Young Award, despite the fact the Brewers fell in seven games to the eventual champion Cardinals. Now, he developed some major arm problems in 1983, and going into 1984 was not ready for opening day, had to go through surgeries, and really had a tough time finding his form afterwards. 85 and 86 seasons, really struggled before eventually getting cut by the Brewers in 1987. Now, because Vukovich settled down in Milwaukee, he and his teammate, Gorman Thomas, opened up a bar together called Stormin' and Vuk's in the suburb of Hales Corners. Very popular place, not only for the locals, but also for the film crew of Major League. I mentioned this in the video I posted yesterday, but if you notice carefully, Pete Vukovich is a star player in that movie. He was originally supposed to be closing pitcher Duke Simpson for the Yankees, but the writers and the directors of Major League, they liked his personality and stature because he was pretty intimidating. So they instead made him star first baseman Clu Haywood. And the directors and the writers also liked Vukovich because of his quirkiness. He was able to come up with some legendary unscripted moments in the film. The most notable one was when Haywood was stepping up to bat in a scene that takes place, I think it's the opening day game between the Indians and the Yankees. They asked him to just improvise, you know, talk to Jake Taylor, talk to, the catcher, you know, what would a batter say as he's stepping into the box? You know, what would a really cocky batter say to the catcher? So Clu Haywood, a.k.a. Pete Vukovich, steps in and without prompting turns to Taylor and says, "Hey, Taylor, how's your wife and my kids doing?" Which is just a legendary burn. So Vukovich fit in rather well. And because Major League, even though it featured the Indians, it was filmed in Milwaukee, he became not only a star movie actor at that point, but also came up with a legendary line delivered to the actor Tom Berenger, who, of course, was playing the role of Jake Taylor. And because of his personality and because the film was shot in Milwaukee, Stormin' and Vuk's became a very popular place for the film crew. Now, he wouldn't keep the movie career going, however, as later on, in fact, just a few years after a Major League came out, he would become a pitching instructor for the Pirates, later the pitching coach for the Pirates in the late 90s, and would become a special assistant to the general manager in Pittsburgh, also in Seattle. And he is currently a scout for the Arizona Diamondbacks and still makes his home in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Finally, a great picture, and I pointed this out on the video, but also a great story, too, because this is one of the most misunderstood and I don't want to say mistreated, but kind of looked down upon player in baseball history. I'm talking about Ivan DeJesus, and we've got his 82 Topps card, card number 484, and it's a great picture of DeJesus pulling a bat out of the rack. He's wearing his Cubs road uniform, and the Cubs, of course, their road uniform in 1981 was that kind of pajama style uniform, the baby blue with the white pinstripes. It wasn't really a good look. They've brought it back a few times for Turn Back the Clock games, but I've never really liked it. Well, in true 82 Tops fashion, the back of DeJesus' card features his stats, but trivia about other players. It's interesting. One of the other players is Jerry Dubinsky, and it says Dubinsky's first major league hit was a homer on April 28th, 1980 versus Texas at Cleveland. Okay, thank you very much. So there you go. The trivia of Jerry Dubinsky on the back of Ivan DeJesus' 82 Tops card. Now, Ivan DeJesus, his story is very similar to Gary Templeton, another infielder who is best remembered for being part of a trade that didn't really work out very well for one team. But at the time, it made sense. And we've talked about Ozzie Smith and Gary Templeton. Of course, Smith traded by the Padres to St. Louis for Templeton. And even though Templeton had a very good all-star career with the Padres for several seasons afterwards, well, he wasn't Ozzie Smith. And of course, Smith wins a World Series with the Cardinals in 85 as part of the two other, in 82, I should say, as part of two other World Series teams in 85 and 87 that would lose the World Series. And of course, Hall of Famer. I mean, he's the Wizard of Oz. He would be a cornerstone of the Whitey Herzog teams in St. Louis for many, many years. Well, that was the same situation for Ivan DeJesus, as he was born in Puerto Rico, actually got some playing tips from Roberto Clemente. Clemente was a coach for a Winter League team in Puerto Rico in the late 1960s. He would get drafted by the Los Angeles Dodgers and is coming up as a prospect for the Dodgers in the mid-70s. Well, the Dodgers are trying to make some moves here and there. So they decide to trade DeJesus along with the late Bill Buckner to the Cubs for Rick Monday. And that happened after the 1976 season. Well, that's a trade that worked out well for the Cubs, even though the Cubs were a terrible team in the late 70s. You had Bill Buckner, the hit machine for the Cubs. DeJesus was a very steady middle infielder who worked out well with, you know, specifically at shortstop, but also had some time at second base. Well, the Cubs looking to shake things up again. The Phillies, meanwhile, looking to get a younger shortstop who can play up the middle with Manny Trio, who was the starting second baseman. And the Phillies are, you know, making a push to stay as a contender, 2 years removed from their World Series championship, eventually putting together the Wheeze Kids team of 1983. So the Phillies make the trade of sending veteran shortstop Larry Boa and prospect second baseman Ryan Sandberg to the Cubs for Ivan DeJesus. Now, DeJesus, again, like Gary Templeton, quite capable. Decent hitter, good glove, very speedy. You know, remember those AstroTurf teams? He would fit in well for the Phillies as part of that 1983 World Series team that fell to the Orioles. But he wasn't Ryan Sandberg. You know, Rhino was the, you know, perennial all-star, a Hall of Famer. So Cubs fans have never forgiven A, the Cubs, and B, Ivan DeJesus for that trade, even though it's certainly not his fault. Now, even though Cubs fans shunned Ivan DeJesus, he would go on to star again with the Phillies. Later, the Cardinals in 1985 appeared in the World Series, you know, teaming up with Ozzie Smith, you know, as a utility infielder, and falling to the Royals in 85, and then finishing out his career bouncing around between the Yankees, the Giants, and the Tigers. Now, after he retired, he would become a coach in the minor league system for the LA Dodgers in the early 90s, also the Seattle Mariners and the Houston Astros. And he received the 2003 Player Development Man of the Year Award in the Astros organization. And he was also part of the Cubs coaching staff in the early 2010s, if you will. He was part of Lou Piniella's organization, his coaching staff back in the, I hate saying the 2010s. We'll just say about 10 years ago, right? He was also a minor league manager with the Lexington Legends in Kentucky, and also his son Ivan DeJesus Jr. Played in the Red Sox organization for several years. So again, don't hate on Ivan DeJesus. It's totally not his fault. But, you know, he's just a victim of circumstance. Although he was part of a good trade for the Cubs, because for many years, Cubs fans, Ivan DeJesus and Bill Buckner were the only two good players that you had. All right, Bruce Sutter, you know, he came a little later on down the line, but he was one of a handful of decent players he had, or you had as Cubs fans. But just like Gary Templeton in the Ozzie Smith deal, totally, unfortunately, looked down upon with the trade to the Phillies, in which the Phillies gave up that prospect, Ryan Sandberg, to make a run at a World Series, which they did. But again, much like Gary Templeton wasn't Ozzie Smith, Ivan DeJesus wasn't Ryan Sandberg, and unfortunately has been dealing with the wrath of that trade almost 40 years later. So some interesting stories, some interesting stats, some interesting cards, but really what's more interesting is the backs of those cards. So if you get a chance to look at the backs of these baseball cards, do it. Not necessarily these particular cards, but go through your set, find those interesting cards from yesteryear, and see what you find on the back. You know, the cards with the cartoons, those are the easiest. But if you've got some time and you want to thumb through some of the statistics, the advanced statistics of some of the Fleer or the Bowman cards, or if you want to look through some of the interesting notes from the Donruss cards or the score scouting reports, they're all right there for you. You just got to take the card and flip it over on the B side, as those of us who have been in the radio industry far too long call it. Well, I'm going to call it a show. I've rambled on for far too long here, and I thank you for listening. Again, join us for our next show 2 weeks from today. That is Friday, August the 16th. We'll see what fun and frivolity we get into then. And as always, Wax and Gum Stains is our Twitter feed. It's open 24/7. Feel free to comment and share your thoughts about the show, about the players we talk about, the cards we talk about. And also, if you've got a few extra bucks left over from the National this weekend, make a donation to Wax Ecstatic at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Help fund the show, but also the products that we talk about with your donations. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.